The court appreciates your accepting the appointment under the Criminal Justice Act, sir.
I appreciate being appointed, Your Honor. I enjoy the work. Please, the court. Counsel. I'm Steve Nesson. I'm the attorney for Azizia Peterson, the appellant in this matter. Just as a quick background on the facts of this, my client is a black woman who is currently serving a term in the penitentiary after being convicted in this case. And at the time that this all began, Mrs. Peterson met her husband. She was an exotic black dancer, lived in Minneapolis, traveled to South Dakota, which is where they met. They eventually married. The evidence at the trial showed that the two of them entered into an enterprise selling crack cocaine because of her husband's financial difficulties. He was a farmer. Things weren't going well. The marriage ultimately failed. The husband served divorce papers on his wife. Also served by the sheriff was an order for her to leave the premises, at which point Mrs. Peterson revealed to the police or to the sheriff what had been going on as far as the drug dealing, that sort of thing. They were both arrested, and they were both initially charged on an information in federal court. Now, before her husband cooperated, this all occurred February 1st of, I believe, 2010. And before her husband cooperated, Mrs. Peterson was, I guess I would say, interviewed by a DEA agent. And during that interview, he expressed to her that they didn't think that she was believable and that she was facing a mandatory minimum 10-year prison sentence. Then the following day, her husband made a proffer interview with the same DEA agent. And approximately a month after that, the prosecutor received separate indictments, the first charging the husband with a crime carrying a mandatory minimum 5 years, the second charging his wife for exactly the same conduct with a crime carrying a mandatory minimum 10-year sentence. My client moved to dismiss the indictment, alleging that she felt her charges were more harsh than those of her husband, in part at least, if not totally, because she was a black female and he was a white male. The government responded to that motion, telling the court, no, the difference in the charges was because he cooperated and she didn't. Now, in the affidavit that was submitted in support of the motion for the appellant, it was probably inartfully stated in paragraph 19 of that affidavit, 18 and 19, about how she didn't really feel, after she'd been told that they viewed her as a liar, that there was much of a point trying to cooperate because they weren't going to believe what she had to say anyway. Judge Schreier ruled that the appellant had not met or crossed the threshold required to show that she was subjected to a denial of equal protection of the law because of this harsher sentence that she was facing. The Judge Schreier used the two-prong test, the first whether or not she was similarly situated, the second being whether or not she'd shown intentional discrimination. And in making the motion, the appellant asked the court to allow the appellant a hearing on the motion for the opportunity to test both the allegations and the rationales offered by the government in response for the difference in charges. Judge Schreier denied that, saying that she hadn't proven either of the prongs, so there was no need for a hearing. Now, in the appeal to this court,
I don't think it was that she hadn't proven them, it's that she hadn't made a sufficient prima facie case, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And in the appeal, we're contending that, first of all, the judge, in reaching her decision, I find in doing the research and looking at other decisions on the same issue that the district courts, I think, have a tendency to too easily dismiss the idea that someone may be subject to unequal protection. Now, and I want to look at the issue of whether or not a hearing should have been held. It's my understanding, and Judge Schreier's decision says, that she had not made a prima facie case. And it's my understanding that a prima facie case is one where a person comes forward with facts which, if unrebutted by the other side, would support their claim. In other words, a court could find, if the other side remained silent or did not deny those facts, for the plaintiff or the person bringing forward that claim. I believe that there were sufficient facts presented to the court to establish a prima facie case, sufficient to at least have a hearing to allow the court to...
What are the key facts that you think establish a prima facie case?
Well, the fact, first of all, she's in a protected class.
All right. That can't be enough by itself. No, but go ahead, give us the others.
The harshness of the difference between the allegation against her husband and herself based on the same facts on the same drugs.
How about the cooperation?
And the cooperation is one of the issues that should have been tested in a hearing as to whether or not, why is it that the government considered her to be untruthful? Would the government have believed anything she would have said in the event that she would have?
So how would that hearing look? What would that hearing look like? You would have a DEA agent on the stand explaining why he didn't find her credible?
That's correct.
And you'd have a judge deciding whether to credit the agent's reasons for why he didn't find her credible?
That would be part of the judge's job, yes, Your Honor. But it would be a chance for at least the judge to hear these things out and for the defense to actually explore and potentially uncover evidence that without a hearing, there's no way for a defendant to uncover, and that being motive or why someone acts or feels a particular way or how they would act or feel in a future event. I mean, those are not subjects that are easily discoverable otherwise, other than through cross-examination.
Counsel, could you tell at that point of the game the great difference in criminal history, a criminal history 1 versus a criminal history 6?
Yeah, I believe she had a substantial criminal history based mainly on small run-ins with the
law.
That
was known at the time of the denial of the motion to dismiss.
Yes. Yes. But I don't believe, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't believe that that was one of the reasons for the disparity in the charging decision in this case. I believe and Judge Schreier, I think, pointed to it as well when she said in her decision that that the government had indicated they felt she was lying Well, we never had an opportunity to ask them why.
I read a lot of your brief as being kind of a, there has to be something like a fair opportunity to cooperate.
That's one of the problems that a defendant can face is, obviously, if they've got the perception that there's nothing they can say to the government that's going to satisfy the government or be believed by the government, even if it's totally truthful, then what's the point? That's from my client, that's the feeling that I established with her.
But the only reason that would be relevant is if the government's view of her is based on her race or her sex. But if they just arbitrarily, or maybe you would say even arbitrariness is unconstitutional, but that, you haven't raised that. You've just raised race and sex.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Would you tell
so if the government agent just says, I'm not buying what you say, and there's not really a good basis for it, it's just a gut feeling by the agent, you have no recourse?
I can explore with the agent why they have that gut feeling. I can try and determine, is this something, I mean, we all like to think that we exhibit our better angels all the time, but there are times when, you know, we exhibit a bad side to ourselves.
So am I to conclude that when your client was interviewed by the DEA agent, she admitted that she was responsible for all of the drugs and gave detailed information about how she and her husband had engaged in this drug dealing operation?
No, Your Honor, that is not.
That's not what she did.
That's not what she did.
What did she do?
As a matter of fact, it was an extremely short interview.
She said, I'm not involved in it. It's his dope.
Basically, that is what she said, yes.
And when he got the proffer letter, he ran in there and says, it's my dope. It's actually our dope, but and what can I do, Mr. Government, to help you?
That's correct.
And just looking at those circumstances, how can you say your client is similarly situated to the white guy?
The position we've taken is that to determine she's not similarly situated simply by virtue of the fact that he gets a successful proffer in and she doesn't, after she's been told that she's unbelievable.
Well, wasn't she unbelievable?
The agents concluded that, but I have no idea why.
Well, they go out and execute a search warrant on this farm, right?
Well, Your Honor, actually, she showed them where the drugs were and everybody.
Yeah. If she knew nothing about this little family business, what's she doing showing them where the drugs are?
No, we're not alleging that she didn't know. I mean, the trial court found that, the jury found that she was involved in it.
I know, but that's not what she told the agent, is it?
She
was not forthcoming with the agent.
Not initially, no.
But the white guy was, right?
Yes.
So how are they similarly situated?
Well, at the point where she's initially interviewed, I mean, she's basically told, not going to believe you, not going to believe anything you have to say. And so her husband makes a proffer, and he's cooperated. From that point on, my client's view is that she cannot make a proffer that is going to fulfill the she's not going to make a proffer that the agents are going to believe.
You concede, don't you, that her initial proffer was untrue?
Yes.
So you got a liar versus a truth teller.
Well, I would. It wasn't a proffer in the sense of, you know, the proffer letter, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It was an interview, very short interview in the jail in Mitchell, South Dakota. And so Her answers were evasive. Her answers pointed more to her husband. Yes, I would. But the agent walked in there with the attitude, and I think the videotape that was taken of this shows that the agent walked in there with the attitude that he was not going to believe anything she had to say.
Would you like to? I think your time's expired, so we'll hear from Mr. Clapper. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Nesson.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, on behalf of the U.S. Attorney's Office from the District of South Dakota, we would respectfully request that you affirm the district court's denial of Azizia Peterson's motion to dismiss that was based on her claim of selective prosecution, of an improper prosecution based on race. Although she was initially charged with her husband by complaint with the same charge, he cooperated, and he did that right away, and she did not. And she was given opportunities to do that, and she continued not to cooperate, and that led to eventual different charges from the grand jury. And that really is the sum of this case. These two defendants were not similarly situated based on his cooperation. And his cooperation came from the get-go. As the court knows from the facts of this case, what happened on February 1st, 2010 is not how Milton Peterson expected that night to go. He expected to have divorce papers served on her by the sheriff and to have her removed from the home. It took a big change when she told she was going to have to leave, and she started pointing out that her husband was a drug dealer. And then she proceeded to show the sheriff where drugs were located in the house. And directly on the point that you made, Judge, is how could she not be involved when she knew where the drugs were? There were drugs in their bedroom that they shared together in multiple places that she showed the sheriff. There were drugs in the kitchen, drug residue on a Pyrex bowl where it was cooked in the kitchen to turn cocaine powder into crack cocaine. I mean, clearly she had involvement in this family business, and refused to acknowledge any culpability at all. So from that very moment, her credibility was in question. Milton Peterson, on the other hand, when he was confronted with this, not only admitted to his involvement in this, but proceeded to show the sheriff where other drugs were located, and subsequently cooperated even further with law enforcement about all of the drug dealing that had been occurring from its inception with his wife.
I don't understand the difference in charges, though. I thought you all weren't supposed to charge bargain on facts to directly affect a sentence. You were trying to avoid imposing the 10-year statutory minimum on this guy, right?
It appears, I mean, the charge he was indicted with had the five-year mandatory
minimum. 5 to 40.
Correct.
And you hit here with the 10-year statutory minimum, right?
Correct.
Same drug quantity, right?
Same, yes. Both were involved in the same activity.
So you swallowed some dope to charge him with a 5 to 40, and you wouldn't swallow it for her. I didn't think you guys, under the old Thornburg memo and the iterations of that thing, were supposed to do that.
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. All I know is the charging decision was made, and to be honest with you, I wasn't involved in that. I got the case when we went to trial.
No, but I get to beat up on you, so you're
going. Yeah, and I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Go ahead.
Counsel, let me ask you this question.
Sure.
As I understand the law of this court in several cases, It's up to them to find, to come forward with some credible evidence that race and gender played a role. Do you believe that's the law?
It's even more than that, I believe, Judge. It's that the burden on them is to get a hearing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the judge didn't even grant a hearing in this case, but to get
to get a hearing, don't they have to have some credible evidence?
They have to have some credible evidence that creates a reasonable doubt about the constitutionality of the prosecution.
Are you saying, by the way you're posing this case, that a defendant's testimony can never be credible on this issue, if that's all there is?
No, I wouldn't say that at all.
You think there could be a case where the defendant's testimony alone, defendant's affidavit alone, is enough to get a hearing?
To make allegations of racially motivated prosecution. Is that your question?
Sure. I'm doing the two prongs. So I'm assuming that. Go ahead.
Sure. I think that's possible. Definitely. But we don't have that in this case.
Because she's incredible?
No. They didn't make any factual allegations that support the reasoning that these charges were made for improper selective prosecution.
You're saying if she filed an affidavit that said the DEA agent told me I couldn't cooperate because I don't let African Americans cooperate, then she could have gotten a hearing.
Absolutely.
But here, she didn't say that. And there were other facts that showed why the two were not similar.
Right. We have a motion to dismiss making this claim. And we have an affidavit, 6 pages long. It's 23 paragraphs, I believe. Other than her claiming that she's in a protected class, either by race or gender, there's no, and the fact that she was charged differently than her husband, there's no other factual allegation made that there's was something improper or that there's some improper motive that occurred in the charging decision. Without that, she hasn't met her burden, hasn't made it past the first step, let alone the second. And we certainly, the district court was right in not granting a hearing. The proposed hearing that was discussed here on the defendant's argument I don't foresee that ever happening, where we have a hearing and we put agents or prosecutors on the stand as to question them about their intentions or their decisions in making prosecution decisions.
That affidavit's available to us. I've not looked for it.
That's in the addendum to the Azizia Peterson's brief.
Thank you.
Yes.
You might have overstated the point a little bit there when you say there could never be a scenario when law enforcement people can be questioned about their discretionary decisions, because I think don't you think the cases about how a hearing is available if there's a substantial prima facie showing on why the government didn't file the substantial assistance motion or something else contemplate that such a hearing is possible?
Yes, Your Honor, I did overstate. I meant under, like, the facts that we have in this case, where you just have an allegation of some improper decision.
Right, so it's a fact-based, you're not arguing as a legal matter that it's not available. This is just a question of sufficiency of the evidence in this case.
Right.
We disagree. We think the evidence here was sufficient that she's made a prima facie showing, and the district court erred in that regard, then there's no barrier legally to requiring a hearing.
Correct.
All right.
I think the point I was trying to make, when we have an affidavit similar to this and we have just merely an allegation of some discriminatory selective prosecution here, that's not without more allegations factually. It shouldn't open up some fishing expedition for a discovery hearing to put a prosecutor and agent on the stand as to what went into the charging decisions, unless there is some factual allegation of some racially motivated comment that somebody overheard, and that's given to the court. But we don't have that in this case. We have a lot of facts that aren't in dispute in this case.
Although the evidence against both of them is essentially identical, right? And one got hit with a 10-year statutory minimum, and the one got hit with a 5-year, right?
Yes, except the one difference.
I'm not talking about the cooperation. I'm talking about the facts of the crime.
The drug dealing conspiracy facts would be similar, yes.
No, similar, identical, right?
Identical.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Credibility of a witness or a defendant.
No, I'm just talking about what y'all would have proved if had you jointly gone to trial with two of them. The facts would have been identical. And the judge knew that when she was deciding whether to grant a motion to dismiss. And all she sees is you got a black woman, a 5-year statutory minimum, a 10-year statutory minimum, the facts are identical, and then you add the cooperation point.
The facts are identical, and the cooperation point is the separating issue in this case that does make them dissimilar, and it supports the district court's decision to deny the motion to dismiss.
Now, did the husband, did the record show here what happened in the husband's case at sentencing?
He received the safety valve, right?
He did cooperate at trial. He would have received the 5-year mandatory minimum, and I don't know that he had. Did we put it in our footnote? I think he got the. He did. You're right.
He got the safety valve.
He got a safety valve.
He got 37 months imprisonment.
Right.
It's in your briefs. I mean, you know, it's the only place I know it from.
Correct.
Safety valve. You mean under the statute, he was sentenced below the minimum.
But correct, because he had no prior criminal history.
There was no motion for substantial assistance.
No, not yet.
And then his sentence was later amended to 17 months, correct?
That I'm not aware of, Judge.
Well, he got a huge break because you didn't
May 18,
based on why was it amended to 17 months? A substantial assistance motion or?
That could be. I did not handle the prosecution of.
Yeah, but you're the attorney for the government, so we assume that you would have checked into this.
May 18 of this year.
Well, we'll look and see if it's in the record. Do you have anything else, Mr. Clapper?
I do not, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you for the argument. The case is submitted, and we'll file an opinion in due course. Thank you both for your arguments.